Just get the tape up to speed, and there we go. This is tape two, talking with Larry Laverance. He went into Kansas City and got a job at Health and Human Services and working with a youth program. And what happened after that?
Well, I was there in the youth program probably 4 or 5 months, and he had a real problem with the administrative officer. So Bob switched me over to becoming his admin officer. Uh-huh. And I did that for a couple years, and then I eventually went into quality control and assistance payments, which were essentially the AFDC program. Uh-huh. And 75, of course, the refugees came in, and I worked a little bit on the refugee program in 75. Reorganization, I went into the Medicaid program. I was the Medicaid program, about 3 years, 1980, the Refugee Act was passed, and they established regional positions in HHS and the refugee program. So in 1980, I went into the refugee program, mm-hmm. in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. And from then on, I'm going to want to come back and talk about the refugee program for a moment, but bring me up to speed career-wise since then.
Well, I worked from 1980 to 1990, worked in the refugee program, and then in 1991, they abolished the refugee positions in the regions, and I went into more conventional programs of AFDC and child care regulations. So I worked there in that program for about 2 years, and I got totally fed up with the situation, and I took early retirement in 92.
Mm-hmm.
And went to work for a local agency in Kansas City by the name of the Don Bosco Agency.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I did not, or the director of that, and I did not agree on things. He was doing things I didn't like,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted feedback, so I gave him feedback, so he fired me in March of 1992, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I resigned in 91. So then I went into real estate. I was in real estate 11 years.
Yeah.
Until December of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back into as a contract employee with the Office of Refugee Resettlement in 2003. That's where I am now.
Now, that's wonderful. So you're still working?
Right, I'm still working.
Yeah, that's great. And
actually, I work on something called the Rural Initiative.
Uh-huh. And what's that?
Well, generally it's to get into farming, small truck gardening, growing specialty crops, things like that around the country. So we've got some demonstration projects where the idea is to get refugees more involved in small farm operations, intensive farming, and also value-added products.
Well, let's look at this interest in refugee resettlement. Actually, there were so few Americans who spoke Vietnamese in the late 70s that many IVSers served to assist the integration of immigrants Vietnamese. How did that? What was that like in the early years when you? Here, give me 1 second here. I'll just stop this. Let me shut this machine off for a split second here. Up again. So, a lot of IBSers became active in helping with the settlement of refugees. How did you become involved in refugee issues?
Well, most people knew my background and. The region was small enough that they knew my background, so they knew that I was a logical person, and the job was posted, of course, and I competed for the job. I'm not sure I did. I think I may have just been reassigned. I guess I was just reassigned to the position because of my background. And then at that point, the refugee program was in the office of the regional director. Actually, it was called the principal regional official then. Under the Carter administration.
And so this is, and so how did that progress? What were some of your duties?
Well, we had responded, there were three of us in the office, and because of politics, I did not become the regional director, even though I should have been, and I was some bad timing and politics. They put a former regional director that was coming back from an intergovernmental personnel act assignment and as head of the refugee program, even though it was only three of us in the office. So I became a program officer, and I essentially worked with Missouri and Iowa, and the other fellow worked with Kansas and Nebraska. Of course, the states administered the cash and medical assistance programs, and at that time they were 3 years in length. They had social service funds, which were for employment and English teaching, so forth. And every year I worked with a Department of Education guy, great guy named Bud Toomey, T-U-M-Y, who started the Refugee Materials Center in Kansas City back in 1981 to hold a conference. We had, you know, between 250 and 400 people every year at these conferences, Joint Education, HHS workshop conference. It was good by most HHS standards. I mean, it was the closest thing I could find that was that tied back to Vietnam. There was some independence. It was not steeped in bureaucratic, you know, regulations and traditions and so forth. So there was an opportunity to go out and work with state and local people on programs and advise them. So I did monitoring. You know, reviewed financial reports. Essentially, you know, as I said, there was certainly some room for creativity compared to most federal operations.
Well, that's okay. My wife left the Library of Congress for the same reason.
Yeah.
It just was not possible to do things, and money was tight, especially during the Carter administration. And so,
1970s, I was a fish out of water, to be honest. I mean, I got good appraisals, and I did. My work was regarded as being good work, but we were getting into AFDC and Medicaid, and those programs are so complex with such bureaucratic tendencies and so steeped in regulations. You know, it was so totally different from what I was used to in Vietnam, where it was a lot more freewheeling and you could make your own decisions. So I really was not particularly happy camper in the 70s.
Well put. So what was the work like in the 80s and the 90s?
Well, the 80s was good. In 85, I guess it was, they decided to, this is another story, but George Bush, because of his ties to the Cubans, decided that nine of the OR slots should be assigned to the state of Florida, which meant that the regions had to give up some slots. So they put me under they put Kansas City under the Denver region. So I worked for Ed Lapidus then. I was regional director for about a year and a half. Dr. Burnett went to the aging program, so I became the regional director, acting regional director of ORR. Then they combined the regions with Denver, so I went under Ed Lapidus because I was had less status, obviously. And I worked Ed had pretty well broke his bridges with Colorado, so he assigned me to Colorado, and he took Iowa. And that was actually a very good time. I worked very well. State Refugee Coordinator was a very creative lady, very dynamic, was always one step ahead of ORR. And so I had a very good rapport and had a good relationship with her.
Right. ORR, could you just state an acronym? Office of?
Refugee Resettlement.
ORR. Good. I just misheard. Great. And so things worked out well in Colorado.
Right.
Now, are you dealing, what's the largest part refugee population then?
Well, Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
We're the largest group, of course, and the Hmong were becoming much more dominant in the early 80s. Lao and Cambodia to some extent. Some Soviet refugees, former Soviet refugees, uh-huh. were coming in. But really the groups that were most dominant were the Vietnamese and the Hmong.
Mm-hmm. Were there many Hmong in Colorado?
I didn't work with the Hmong very much in Colorado. Mm-hmm. There were some Hmong there, there was a pretty good sized Hmong population in Kansas City, Kansas, and there were quite a few Hmong in Iowa. So I had some contact with the Hmong there.
No, the reason I ask is at least Colorado has mountains.
Right. No, I don't. Yeah, there were, as I recall, quite a few Hmong, but again, the Vietnamese were the dominant group in Colorado.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. By the way, is that a myth? I mean, most Hmong that I know these days are either in Milwaukee or in Long Beach, California. Neither places you would expect Hmong to be quite comfortable with. Vung Pao, of course, is in what, Montana?
Montana, I think.
Yeah, but is that was that really a refugee issue? I mean, were Hmong just as comfortable, given the right support, in Iowa as they might be in Idaho?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the areas that were the Hmong are most the highest population of Hmong are Long Beach, Fresno,
mm-hmm.
heavy Hmong population in Fresno, California, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
Those are the three states that have the most groups mm-hmm. and. The Hmong, you know, would go to an area, and if they were satisfied with the support and the opportunities there, the others would come in. And, you know, one or two families came into Kansas City, Kansas, they were pleased with response they had. So there was at one time about 1,000 Hmong that lived in Kansas City, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
The Hmong are into poultry farming now, and apparently, a couple of Hmong went into Western Arkansas, Eastern Oklahoma, and Southern Missouri. I think also Georgia and North Carolina, and bought bought a poultry operation,
mm-hmm.
and made them work. So now there's quite a number of Hmong and a few Lao that are raising poultry in these confinement poultry operations.
Right. Well, I live in North Georgia, so I know what a confinement poultry operation looks like.
Yeah.
Well, that is very fascinating. So you're still working.
Mm-hmm.
And, I noticed 806. Where do you live?
Well, my home is... Kansas City, of course, near Kansas City, but I'm living in Alexandria, Virginia.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. That's where I'm sitting right now.
Uh-huh. And your wife and family, how did that develop over the years?
Well, my wife is still in Kearney, which is just outside of Kansas City.
I know where that is, yeah.
I have a son who's a minister in Dayton, Ohio, Presbyterian minister.
Uh-huh.
He's got his wife's brains. He has two master's degrees from Princeton Theological Seminary, master's from Vanderbilt. My daughter, I should say our daughter, was Peace Corps volunteer in Africa. Has finished her coursework for a doctorate of public health at Johns Hopkins.
Great.
And is looking for a dissertation topic. Lives here in Washington, D.C., so I see her every week or 10 days. Mm-hmm. So kids have done very well.
I think you've done very well. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, I'm glad. I hope I gave you some new insights, Mark.
Yes, you filled in a lot of blanks here and there, actually, that are quite useful down the road. Paul Riddell originally believed we'd write a book. There's a kind of pattern for writing oral histories. There's an oral history of the Peace Corps, for example, in which you construct the history just from the oral histories of the people, you know, of the volunteers themselves. My interest, of course, was the David Gitelson route. I just wanted to get these voices as part of the archival record of Southeast Asia, because the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia is perceived as being all military. And I wanted an archive of non-military lives in which the United States intersected with the people of Southeast Asia. And we've completed that, so I'm delighted, and you've given us some insight into that. So
did you read the book where one of the authors was Harvey Meese?
Oh, sure, I have it right behind my desk. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean that's a good book, and uh-huh. What's the name of the first guy in there? And the first author, I met him in a year and a half ago. The guy who worked with Zim in the late 50s.
Right.
He was way ahead of his time. He was, he was years and years ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly enough, I was going to write a biography of a very early advisor in 62, who came back later, actually. But that got me into these interviews, as it turned out, were quite helpful, confirming everything that I had found. And then when that book came out, after I'd already published what I wanted to do, that book came out, and it was terrific, because it was just in time to add a couple of devastating footnotes. You know, academics really love those. So.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so the book was very useful there. And you know, I think it's almost a manual, you know, of what to do and what not to do.
Right.
And I don't think anyone's reading it, unfortunately. I don't mean that book.
Yeah.
I'm giving a paper at a conference next week about nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Oh, really?
And my feeling is we didn't learn anything. What do you think? Have you had any chance to think about it at all?
Well, I don't think we've taken the lessons.
No.
I don't think we show the right respect for them and their culture. I think we still are too arrogant. So I don't think we've taken the lessons from Vietnam and applied them very well. My understanding is that instead of putting nation building experts in Iraq, we've got political people. And I've been told of one person who is over there because of politics, and this person, by all accounts, is a loose cannon. I don't know what she's doing exactly, but the refugee program, at least, you know, frankly, was not what you wanted. So I guess the long answer to your question is yes.
Yeah. Well. I
will tell you one story.
Oh, I'd love to.
This or not.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you ask about, you taught me, you mentioned Phil Schreiber, and you mentioned my attitude towards AID people, or USAM people, USAID people. When I was in Phan Rang, my first month, there was a USAM advisor named Bodie Wilson, who was a grass agronomist out of Oklahoma. I used to come up about every week to Top Cham because of the experimental station there, and because he liked Don Schmidt, Don was, by the way, an excellent agronomist, technical advisor. But Bodie used to come up, and Bodie used to like to drink a little bit, so, you know, I always thought Bodie was, you know, sort of just, putting his time in, and that was about all. And he used to brag on Phil Schreiber. He'd say, God, isn't he beautiful? God, what happened to you and me, Larry? You know, it's like that. He used to brag on him. Of course, Phil had movie star looks.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he's still good looking.
He's still, yes.
But, I mean, he was really good looking, you know, when he was in his 20s and uh-huh. had that smile, that personality and so forth. And Bodie used to brag about him. So I always, you know, never thought too much of Bodie. I mean, he was okay, and he treated me, he was okay, he's fine. We were outside the house one day in Top Chum. I was out there when there were a bunch of kids there, and there's always one kid who was dirty and wore ragged clothes, and the other kids made fun of this little kid. And I forget his name, but so I went outside one day, and these kids were outside our house, as they were often. One kid was there, and he had this really snotty nose, snot running out of his nose. I just sort of looked at it and sort of, you know, ignored it. Bodie walked out of the house, and he saw this little kid, and Bodie put his hand on the back of his head and took his handkerchief out of his pocket and gently wiped this little boy's nose and face. My attitude towards Bodie Wilson changed 180 degrees. Because of that.
It's hard to stereotype, isn't it? Well, it's easy to stereotype.
Right.
It's hard to see the nuances always.
Well, he's a better man than I am, because I just, you know, look the other way.
Right.
I did a little thing there's an IBS agricultural union in Agri Union in Santa Fe in May. And I did a little thing for that, a little bit about the early folly of being an IVS. Maybe I should send that to you if you're interested.
I would very much like to have that. Yeah, if you can email it to me, it'd be terrific.
I'll have my wife email that to you.
Great. And when is do you know when in May this is?
I think it's the weekend of May 22nd.
Oh. Do you know who's organizing it?
Clyde Eastman.
Oh, great. Okay, I was going to call Clyde actually this weekend.
Yeah.
So that fits in very well, because I might like to come.
Okay.
It's not hard to make me to go to Santa Fe. It's a
I've never been there, so I'm looking forward to going.
Oh, it's nice. Taos is nicer. If you have, just in case I'm not there. There's a town called Chamayo, Chamayo, between Albuquerque and Santa Fe.
Uh-huh.
And it's become these days a bit of an artist colony, not too much. It's really a bump in the road, the way you and I remember bumps in the road from a long
right.
time ago. It has a Catholic church there, which is hundreds of years old, which is very famous for its healing capacity, and people walk all the way up from northern Mexico on pilgrimage around Easter time to visit this and to bring back some dirt from this church. And my wife and I went there, and we're not big on miracle healing or anything else, but it was one of those places where you visit, like I've been to the Buddha's birthplace, those kinds of things,
yeah.
where you can just feel it's a almost an energy that radiates from the place. And I asked to speak to the priest, who is like an 80-year-old toothless Italian who'd been assigned by the Catholic Church to this place. And I said, so what do you think of your posting? And he said, this is a really nice place. And it's in the middle of nowhere, but its holiness is really profound. So if you end up, you know, grabbing a car or something, it's a nice little drive. It's a very small place, but it's a unusual, and if it affects you in any way, you bring back something more than just, you know, the Indians selling jewelry around the town square in Santa Fe and stuff like that.
Okay. But, I think Clyde may have sent some stuff out on that. He sent some stuff, some tourist type information.
Right.
That may have been in there. That name rings a bell for me.
Okay. Well, actually, all I need from you, actually, if I can get it, is Phil Schreiber's email address.
Let me email that to you tomorrow.
Okay, that'd be great.
I'll make a note and try to email that to you tomorrow.
And you will actually save me maybe an hour of hunting if you can send me the email, Clyde Eastman's email address, just in case I can't come up with it this weekend.
Okay.
Or a phone number if you have one.
Well, I have information on the Clyde, so I'm sure I can get it for you.
Great. Okay, well, this has been my great pleasure, and hopefully I'll get to see you in May.
Okay.
And keep doing good work, okay?
Okay, thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, you bet.
Bye-bye.